Chapter 34. October AD 2061. Year 5 ERC. Summer. Tash thought she heard Charlie Marlowe's booming voice before she and Grace even came through the door into the big, gloomy conference chamber that dominated the cabinet war rooms. "That damn comet," Marlowe growled. "I get asked about nothing else but Halley. And there's nothing to ask about since it's not even there. Is this where we throw our coats?" And she faded out for now. Tash looked around, taking in the place. Gloomy, low-ceilinged rooms in a network of basement bunkers and corridors. All of this was deep under Whitehall, a structure of massive girders and concrete that suggested strength and resilience. But over a century old, and already half full of guests in expensive gear, chatting loudly, glasses in hand. It was cramped, claustrophobic, even smelled slightly damp. And yet Tash found she welcomed being stuck down this hole in the ground, sooner that than under a big open sky, given her lingering post-blink phobia. "Amazing place," she murmured to Grace Butterworth, as the pair of them pushed towards a table of drinks. "Amazingly drab, anyhow. Where Churchill held his wartime cabinet meetings, sheltering from German bombs. Then a museum for decades, a monument, abandoned to the flooding for more decades. Then drained and fixed up, at huge expense, to be used as a grubby political symbol for the new BRP government." Grace grinned, but tentatively, glancing around to be sure they weren't overheard. And her attention always drawn to the group deeper in the room at the centre of which her principal charge, Fred Bowles, held his own court. "Bit cynical, that, for you, Brand. I'm the embittered military vet, remember? You're a different kind of cliché, the idealistic junior worker." Tash had to laugh. "Am I that obvious?" But Grace was looking away again, not focusing. Tash knew Grace was particularly concerned today about her sister and family, who were still stuck in Naples, on the flank of what was rapidly becoming one of the more restless of the world's massive eruption-probable volcano candidates. The sister still couldn't get out, and Grace herself couldn't find a way to get her into England, thanks to the draconian travel and migration bans Mara Kane had imposed soon after coming into office 2 years back. All Grace could do was fret from afar. "Anyway," Tash said, trying to be bright, and looking to the centre of the room. "There's the reason we're all here, not Churchill relics, a planet." That centre was dominated by a huge image projector system. For now, the air above it was populated only by stock images of Mercury, diagrams of the planet's location in the solar system, and crude graphics of the Jones Inc. Pathfinder spacecraft, a tiny hull dwarfed by the immense sail scoop to which it was attached. "I wonder what Churchill would have made of that," she mused. "I think the old guy would have been impressed." They both turned, a soft American voice coming from a soldier, no, an airman, Tash recognised from the blue uniform colour. Tall, blonde, hat under his arm, handsome in a somewhat sterile way, Tash thought. "My name's Harry Regent, forgive me for butting in." Harry Regent, she remembered that name. "Oh, you were with Chi on the Lodestone, on Blink Day, right? And Tash Brand, right? He often mentioned you, his old college buddies. Knowing you'd be here, I searched for your name badge. Sorry to hold you up if..." "Not at all," Tash said. "We're supposed to be circulating." She introduced Grace. "I guess you know I'm a PA of Fred Bowles, the big guy holding court over there." And Grace watches his back. The airman eyed Grace. "Military, right? Or X?" "I recognise the bearing." Grace smiled warily. "Royal Marines, formerly." Regent nodded. "I'm impressed." "Ha, really? Maybe I waved at you flyboys from the trenches in some battle zone, while we got on with the fighting." Regent grinned back. "Unlikely. I never saw action with the USAF before I made it to the astronaut corps. But I got drafted back in, after the blink, tougher times." Grace nodded grudgingly. "Tougher times indeed. Even soldiers have family, right?" A look passed between them, a kind of glance of recognition that puzzled Tash and vaguely concerned her. If they hadn't met before, How come Regent could make such a spot-on remark to Grace? It was almost as if he had researched her, which made no sense. Maybe she was getting paranoid, like the whole world. But Grace had slipped back into her usual on-duty mode, sipping her drink silently, every so often casting glances over at the knot of people around Fred Bowles. Tash turned to Regent. So, when did you last see she? About a year ago, on the Lodestone, actually. But I was already back in the USAF, even then, escorting Lee Yamanaka at the time. We were initiating this Mercury Flight sub-project, in fact. I haven't seen she in, well, more than your year. We keep in touch when we can, and security permits it. She glanced at the recycling display of stock imagery. Strange to think he'll be watching the exact same images as us. But a few seconds later, Regent said, what with the station being on the other side of the Earth from the Sun, and so that bit further from Mercury. Grace said, so we'll hear what becomes of their mates at Mercury before the Lodestone crew do. Space stuff is weird. Regent grinned, which is pretty much what my current boss says. He nodded across the room to the group of dignitaries clustered around Fred Bowles. That short guy over there, current US ambassador to London. My background is why he likes having me in his personal protection squad, I think. I can pull a gun and explain the space stuff, as you call it, Grace. Or at least cover for him when his bluff goes wrong. I heard that, said Charlie Marlowe, loudly, pushing her way through a gathering crush, trailed, Tash saw, by a fraught-looking Mel Kapoor. So where's the drinks? Tash pointed her to the drinks table she and Grace had found, but a waiter approached, and Marlowe scooped up the glass of water off her tray and just gulped it down. She grinned cynically. What? Human waiters now? Our glorious new leader really is going for the English traditional look, isn't she, Tash? And bluffing about space stuff, Captain, is it? An ambassador? Bluffing? Surely not. It would be nice to think that by now, nearly 5 years after the intervention of an alien entity in human affairs, our lords and masters would start to learn about scientific matters, rather than how to bluff about them. She glared around. However, look at this lot. Stuffed suits and cocktail dresses, just as it always was. The British upper set always seemed to think an ignorance of science was an actual virtue. And it's got worse under Kane, of course. Tash and Grace shared a wary look, which Marlowe noticed. And shame on any of you who indulges them that way. All these damned questions about the comet, for instance. Grace looked puzzled. What comet? I haven't heard about that. Halley's Comet, Mel said, taking a drink herself. Tash was aware that was the first time she'd spoken. Mel seemed distant, distracted, if not distressed. Hard to read, even for Tash, who knew her so well. But Mel went on dutifully. Halley. Shows up regular as clockwork, every 75 years, more or less. Usually bright in the sky. First recognised in the 18th century. But there are recorded appearances before that. But not this time, Harry Regent said. He quickly introduced himself properly, shook hands with Marlowe and Mel and Regent swapped a couple of lines about she. Even that didn't seem to engage Mel's full attention, Tash saw. Halley, anyhow, Marlowe said. It was due to make an appearance this year. We've looked, no sign of it, as Top Gun here says. Harry grinned at that. Obviously, an after effect of the blink, Marlowe said. The orbits of the planets were shaken up when the sun went away. Well, so were the comet's paths, including Halley, undoubtedly, on its own long, slow, looping trajectory. The blink could have detached it from the solar system altogether. Certainly we will have lost some more distant comets. Or, Harry said, of course, some comets might have been deflected to come closer to the sun than before. Marlowe frowned, she said more softly. Implying, I suppose, that some might have been deflected onto a course leading to impact with Earth? I can tell from the wings on your uniform that you have served in space yourself. At the Lodestone, yes, but I was more flight crew than scientific. then you must understand how irresponsible such loose speculation is at this time, coming from the likes of you. Of us, I mean, just think about it. A given comet may be deflected towards Earth. Another may be deflected away. It isn't hard to show that the overall chance of a damaging impact is exactly the same as before the blink. Even to suggest otherwise. People are frightened enough, Grace said now, sternly. But Harry Regent seemed unaffected by Marlowe's admonition. He turned to Grace. Ma'am, to be frightened of the unknown isn't particularly irrational, especially as there is an agency behind it all. Galaxius, whatever you want to call it, caused all this stuff. Isn't it rational to be angry, to be fearful? After all, do you think Galaxius would care if the blink had accidentally deflected Halley into a collision course with Earth? Marlowe seemed furious. Grace is right. She linked an arm with Regent's and led him away with powerful strides. I think you and I need to have a talk about the dangers of scaremongering, Captain. Grace said, and I better go haunt Fred. She moved away, leaving Mel and Tash alone. Mel looked away, distracted, sipping her drink. For a moment, Tash couldn't think of a thing to say to Mel, one of her oldest friends. They stood there in a kind of anxious silence. Everybody was anxious these days, Tash thought. It was the apparent instability of the post-blink planet that frightened people more than anything specific. So her own work with Bowles had taught her. And there was always family to fret about. She was glad she had her own father, late 60s now, so close by. Grace, for instance, wasn't so lucky, and she wondered about Mel. Another waiter passed, and Tash grabbed a fresh glass of grape juice and handed it to Mel. Try this. So, you okay? Mel pulled a face as she sipped the drink. Christ, this is shit. App food, right? Do I look okay? Not to me. Well, thanks for noticing. Charlie doesn't, hasn't. Never seems to realise that there are times when I have more important things to do than be her bag handler. Let me guess. Jane? Jane, yeah. She's only gone and got herself arrested. Startled, vaguely alarmed, Tash looked over towards Bowles and his entourage, all noisily talking, and pulled Mel into a quiet corner, away from Grace, for one thing. Arrested? Mel nodded, edgy, even frightened. Truth time, and apology time. I would have come here even if Charlie hadn't ordered me to see you. You're hard to get hold of these days, Tash, and maybe I could get your help. Arrested for what? Mel grunted. What have you got? This is Mara Kane's Britain now, Tash, in case you hadn't noticed inside your government house. Half a dozen of Jane's friends, that I know of, have already been in custody, and a couple, I think, are still there. Oh, she's out now. But she's been tagged, and she won't listen. She's 15 years old, Tash. She seemed unable to speak. It occurred to Tash that she had never really seen Mel cry, only, maybe, when the in-jokes had got together in the labour ward after Jane's birth. Jane's mother had been there, and her difficult brother, Paul, muttering prayers like a priest threatened with being defrocked. Wow, nearly 16 years ago. In a pre-blink world that now seemed like an endless summer in her memory. Tash took Mel's hand. Just tell me. Of all the stupid things, it was Kane's calendar that she objected to, the final straw. Tash wasn't terribly surprised, even though she had been on the inside in the development of the English regularised calendar, as responsibility for drawing it up had been handed to a reluctant Fred Bowles, science minister. The reconciling of the old human calendar to the new planetary realities was a chore that had been put off by the old government, save for sticking plaster remedies. The issuing of apps to match up the old calendar dates to the different sunset times and seasonal changes. Well, Mara Kane had fixed that. She was, Fred had dryly observed, the kind of person who liked drawing up rules for other people to follow. But as a scientist, Tash half admired the brutal clarity of Kane's scheme. In England, at least, the new long year 20 days longer than the old, was structured as the astronomer's calendar had been before. In the Northern Hemisphere, the astronomical winter had run from the winter solstice to the spring equinox, roughly late December to late March. So now the official year was to start at the northern winter solstice, which, with the new orbit, had already drifted out to March. And the year was broken up into four seasons, capitalized, from 92 to 101 days each. Winter from winter solstice, spring from the spring equinox, summer from the summer solstice, autumn from the autumn equinox, and around to winter and another year. The days were simply numbered within the seasons. And the years, each now 385 days long, were renumbered too. Year one of the English regularised calendar started retrospectively on the winter solstice of 2056, 21st of December, just a couple of weeks before the blink. That detail, the new numbering, seemed to enrage people more than any other. Tash found herself falling into a too familiar defence of the government she served. Well, it was a campaign pledge, you know. People voted for it. Nearly 5 years on from the blink, the old calendar is months out of skew. Something had to be done. I did hear other countries are thinking of adopting it.
I know. But there's something so Orwellian about calling a day the 52nd of summer. Not that Jane and her crew would use a word like Orwellian.
You know who actually started the latest protest march? The astrologers.
Seriously?
Who knew so many people cared so much?
Of course, they ought to be protesting against Galaxius. But you can't reach Galaxius, she sighed.
Oh, none of that matters. So a couple of years ago, Jane was rebelling against me. Now she's rebelling against Mara Kane.
If not the calendar, there would have been something.
There was a sit-in. She went too far. Tash took a step closer to her friend and spoke more quietly. Okay, look, I'll do what I can if she gets into trouble again, but Mel...
Tash, I didn't come here to...
Mel, listen to me. Mel looked faintly shocked to hear her speak like that.
Tash hesitated, choosing her own words cautiously.
You have to see it from the government's point of view, she said now. I mean, it's true that Mara Kane runs a Cobra government, as you may have heard. It's not just a press label, as if we are in a permanent crisis. Not everybody can stand the heat. Fred Bowles can, which is why he's still in a job, even if he is a leftover from the previous regime. And me, in his wake, I suppose. We do our best to mitigate. But we actually are in a permanent unfolding crisis. The whole global system is increasingly frayed. Supply chains failing everywhere. 4 years on from the blink, we are seeing migrations again. Like the climate crisis years. And other portents. In some places, the old fossil fuel reserves are being eyed up again. In the Middle East, for instance. Russia has been watching those oil reserves for, hell, I'd have to be a historian to tell you how long. Mel frowned.
And all this is Kane's excuse, is it? What's her line? England is a small lifeboat, adrift on a treacherous sea. And if you're in a lifeboat, you obey lifeboat rules.
Tash hesitated, praying she wouldn't say anything any more indiscreet. Even under the old regime, she had long been used to being listened to, covertly. And meanwhile, as far as the danger to Jane was concerned, it was an open secret that a year after Kane's election, there were labour camps operating in England. It was, Tash increasingly feared, a system that was designed to keep you inside, if only because you were actually more useful economically that way. Mel was thinking, listening, rather than arguing, which was a good sign. Tash squeezed her arm again.
I'll do all I can to help. Just be discreet, okay?
And keep Jane from getting arrested again. Ground her if you have to. But Mel had turned away, distracted. Something was happening. The volume of chatter was rising to a dull roar, and people, glasses in hand, were starting to drift towards the knot of audio-visual equipment at the heart of the room. Charlie Marlowe clapped her hands over her head and shouted,
Heads up! The Pathfinder flyby is due any minute now.
Immediately, the drift became a crush. Grace Butterworth came up with Harry Regent, glancing around at the melee.
You two follow us.
And she and Harry linked arms and bulldozed their way through the crowd, following Marlowe. Mel and Tash, hand in hand, trailed in their wake. The central display, when they were close enough to see it, turned out to be bewildering at first glance. Fed through from JPL in California, the overall Pioneer Pathfinder Project Control Center on the ground, images and data had been thrown into the air over that complex projection node, including a few spectacular planetary images, evidently of Mercury. Dull red rock, sharp shadows. In the end, Tash managed to pick out something comprehensible. What looked like a countdown clock, working its way down from 5 minutes. 5 minutes to what, though? Closest approach? Then she spotted one spectacular summary graphic. A ghostly grey-black globe with a fine powder-blue rail sweeping past it, and a small bead of light crawling along that rail. Pathfinder making its pass by Mercury, she assumed. And in there too, she saw now, among the clutter of data displays, the calm faces of two women, presumably imaged by in-helmet cameras. Ange Cosello, Ito Katsuo. Tash had never met them, but knew them at second hand through Xi. Talking, though their voices were not relayed, their eyes flickering over out-of-shot instrument displays. Okay, yelled Marlowe. Okay. When nobody paid attention, she shoved her way out of the crowd, dragged a chair from a stack, pulled it back towards the display, and stood on its seat. Mel hurried to hold the chairs back and steady it, evidently alarmed, a sight which made Tash laugh. At least her own nominal charge, Fred, wasn't as impulsive as that.
Okay, Marlowe said again, calling over the dying hubbub. Showtime! Now, as you know, I'm the Astronomer Royal, not the Space Technologist Royal, but I'm the best Fred Bowles could find at short notice.
Tash glanced at her phone, then gave Fred a thumbs up and called, as loudly as she dared.
The Prime Minister is watching from her office, by the way, Charlie.
Marlowe raised her eyebrows. She did have eyebrows built for raising, Tash had often observed.
I'm sure that will make all the difference to the crew, a whole astronomical unit away.
Laughter. But Tash wondered what PM Kane might make of such jokes if she heard them. Such was the environment these days. Now, from her chair, Marlowe had to turn her head, twist her body to see all the displays.
4 minutes to closest approach to the planet. Okay. So let's understand what we're seeing here.
That dim globe is planet Mercury, an image sent down from a remote satellite. It's about 40% Earth's distance from the sun. And as a consequence, its daytime surface temperature is somewhere over 400 degrees Celsius, maybe 700 Kelvin, hot enough to melt lead.
And that's where the Pathfinder is going.
She pointed to another display. An awkward square-frame hull dwarfed by a huge sail scoop ahead of it.
There she is.
But she doesn't look like that now. The big sail is folded away during closest approach. She did use her solar sail to descend from Earth orbit and go swooping down to Mercury, while running her dark energy scoop in parallel. Now she is in free fall, following a close approach trajectory. The closest approach will last only minutes. In a way, Pathfinder is an extension of Sputnik 4, the early uncrewed trial of the dark energy ram scoop technology. That ship had a scoop of graphene, 10 kilometres across, massing only 60 kilograms. Well, the Pathfinder has a scoop sail of an even finer experimental substance, and that 60 kilogram mass allowance gives you 100 kilometres diameter sail. At Mercury, the sail delivers an acceleration of about twice Earth gravity, since the sunlight is that much more intense. But the sail also acts as a dark energy scoop. In this configuration, which delivers an additional acceleration of about 10 microgs, 10 millionths of Earth gravity. That's tiny and makes no practical difference here, but it's measurable,
And it has been measured. The tech works.
There was a ripple of applause, a faintly drunken whoop.
From the point of view of the longer-term objectives, that was the purpose of the mission, to test out the performance of the dark energy ramjet, even if it made no practical difference to the mission trajectory. But right now, Marlowe went on, that's all behind the crew, as they go through their Mercury encounter phase.
Right.
Let me see. Standing precariously on her chair, she swept her hand through the images in the air until she found one she wanted, expanded it with a spreading gesture of her arms. This showed the square frame hull without the sails, and a glittering blanket suspended on a frame above.
That is simulating what Pathfinder looks like right now,
tucked behind that reflective blanket, which is there to deflect solar heat. The sail, come scoop, is folded up and stowed, and every watt of power she can muster is going into the cooling systems. You won't be able to see it, but there is also a ferocious laser, infrared, dumping the heat. The blanket is based on technology used for close approach probes sent to the sun, sandwiches of multi-layer insulation foil, capable of withstanding 500 degrees or more. The images you will soon see of Mercury's surface will be taken by instruments poking through holes in that shield. Tash murmured, that is their cooling system. A bit of foil. Mel smiled, but grimly.
I know, she whispered back.
I spoke to Xi about it. All this was improvised, to some extent. Pioneer expects to get cold, not hot.
Ah, Marlowe called. This is direct from Pathfinder.
A large screen expanded at the heart of the display. A landscape, dull grey, seen from above. Craters everywhere. Like the moon, Tash thought at first glance, although lacking the Maria, seas of old lava dust. Nothing but shades of grey.
Mercury, Mel said.
Astounding to think of it. Some of those big old crater walls look melted, don't they? And we sent those two heroes down there into that pit of heat, in a lashed-up improvisation of a spacecraft, just to get a few images like this, all because we couldn't get the Chinese to speak to us. Tash whispered to Mel,
that's politics for you,
but she probably shouldn't be saying it. A murmur of conversation now. People were discussing the imagery, pointing out features to each other, details of the landscapes of Mercury, including here and there, Tash saw, black specks nestling in the landscape. In another context, she might have thought they were imaging flaws, perhaps. In this context, Chinese self-replicators? But there were many, many of them. A stippling on that lethal surface. Marlowe, still on her chair, held a finger to one ear, evidently listening to a feed. Then she held up her hand, and the hubbub of conversation died away.
Okay. Marlowe said. Remember, this is a live feed as we approach Mercury.
The spacecraft is unpowered right now, just following a steep orbital dive down towards the planet itself. The close approach will deliver a gravitational slingshot, which will hurl the spacecraft away from Mercury and the solar heat as quickly as possible. She touched her ear. Then she reached for another image in the cascade over her head, began to expand it with swipes of her hand. And I think we are getting some meaningful data on those installations you can see on the surface. The pattern of black dots, hard to make out against the grey background, spread out as she went for extreme magnification.
Okay.
I'm told that we are now looking down at what appears to be the most significant area of modification on the planet.
Modification by the Chinese craft, that is.
This is why the Pathfinder was sent to Mercury, and its trajectory was designed to take it over this area at closest approach. To see this, we know the Chinese installations are called acorns. Scatters of these black specks have been observed over much of the planet as the Pathfinder approached. But this is the densest concentration.
Roughly speaking, Marlowe said, I'm told we're looking at a mass of over 1 million placements, those black dots.
This is across an area, you can see it's irregular, roughly 800 kilometres wide. The spots are placed irregularly too, but not quite at random,
none closer than about a kilometre to its neighbour.
Fred Bowles spoke up now. Can I ask a question? 2 years ago, the Chinese sent precisely 2 acorns to Mercury. They were self-replicating on the moon. Evidently, they have been self-replicating on Mercury. So 2 has become 1 million. Does that make sense to you, Charlie?
Marlowe nodded, grim.
The lunar machines were able to replicate, from scratch, in 36 days. So 2 become 4 after 36 days. 4 becomes 8 after 72 days. After 2 years, allowing for failures, you could be looking at 1 million installations easily, or more.
And can you speculate for us about what the Chinese are doing this for? What's the end goal?
Marlowe shrugged. Right now, your guess is as good as mine.
Maybe it's all about industry. Maybe the Chinese mean to get a monopoly on the next great resource load. All that rich ore sitting right next to 1 million-kilometer-wide fusion reactor. From the crowd, maybe the Chinese are planning some kind of emigration to get away from Galaxias. Huge generation starships, built of mercury ore powered by sunlight. Or maybe just their elite. A mocking voice, perhaps Australian.
If so, good riddance!
Laughter. Tash looked around to see who was speaking, but Mel grabbed her arm. Something's wrong. Tash looked back at the display, which had changed drastically in seconds. She saw that the main images had dissolved into pixels. The data feeds had stopped scrolling. The faces of the 2 astronauts were frozen, as in snapshots. A murmur of concerned conversation. Tash saw people pulling phones out of their pockets. Never a good sign, in her experience. Something wrong. Tash's instinct was to get as close to Fred Bowles as she could. She grabbed Mel's hand and started moving that way. She was aware of Grace ahead of her, also hurrying towards Bowles, with a slim, upright figure of Harry Regent beside her. The drama was probably something off in space, at Mercury, but you never knew. Maybe some saboteur was screwing with the feed to the bunker. The concerned conversations hushed, faces turned back to the screens. The interval seemed long. Tash, Mel, Regent, Grace stood together, watching the screens. Charlie Marlowe just looked on, waiting. Then, at last, amid the frozen images, Serena Jones appeared, peering into a camera, in a blue jumpsuit, her greying hair a loose zero-gravity cloud around her head.
My God, Mel murmured. Has she been crying?
Is Serena Jones, CEO of Jones Inc., calling all stations from the Lodestone, our station in the Umbra of Earth. I hope you can hear me. This is a text download in parallel to this transmission. You will have observed we lost the signals from the Pathfinder some minutes ago, at just about the time of its closest approach to Mercury. The Pathfinder had released a squad of observer drones before closest approach, and their reports, with some terminal data, are enabling us to make a first assessment of what has happened. We have a remarkable team here. Terminal. I apologize to the family for my thoughtless use of that word. We have lost Pathfinder. We have lost the crew. It's only minutes since the event. The drones have already sent back enough data to start a tentative reconstruction of what happened. Simply put, our heat protection system failed. There appears to have been a flaw in the attachment of our reflective blanket to the main hull. More failures in other backup system operations. Well, the crew had no time to respond before the internal temperatures in the craft rose catastrophically. The crew were Ange Costello, Ito Katsuo. Costello was the commander of this station, the Lodestone. She volunteered for the Pathfinder mission to widen her skill set. She was able. Ambitious. Katsuo was a veteran of the near-disastrous Almirik Mars mission. She became the first human being ever to visit 2 planets beyond Earth and Moon, Mars, and now Mercury. She would have flown the Pioneer to Centaurus. I will not speculate about the last moments of the crew. Not now. I will not insult them by lecturing you about their bravery. We will assist the families all we can. The data they gathered will be invaluable. As for our task going forward, we have thought through this contingency, we had to, and we have a strategy. The Pioneer will fly, and it will fly on time, given the Barnard Star deadline, now only 7 years away. We will hold our own investigation. We will cooperate with external inquiries. We will fix this, and Pioneer will fly. She will fly as a tribute to those we have lost today. As for myself, I have served as CEO of the company and as project director for Pioneer. I will not resign. Not for now, but I take full responsibility. I will stay on to contribute to the recovery of the project from this setback and to assist the inquiries that must follow. I will revert now to the official channels, specifically through our ground control at JPL. Lodestone, out. Tash had seen government ministers scramble for such responses in such crises. That sounded rehearsed. Already scripted. She must have been ready to deal with the worst, Mel muttered. Wouldn't you? With the transmission over, the war rooms began to empty quickly. Some left hastily, journalists and others with immediate follow-up work to do. Others nucleated around key figures. Marlowe was one, inevitably, as she spoke loudly, clearly, and apparently responsibly on what had just happened. Explaining the observed facts rather than speculating, Tash noted approvingly. And Fred Bowles, as science minister, was another attractor. He was walking towards Marlowe. Tash had to be by his side. She said a hasty goodbye to Mel, promised again to do what she could for Jane. Then she looked for Butterworth and Regent. They were already heading towards Fred Bowles, too. Tash followed as best she could, and they worked through the crowd. They were talking over the noise, loud enough to hear each other, and loud enough for Tash to hear too, as she drew closer. "Can't blame the Chinese for these deaths," Regent said now. "I mean, the Pathfinder wouldn't have been sent to Mercury if the Chinese hadn't gone there. But they wouldn't have done that if not for Galaxius, ultimately. And the Blink." "Damn right." "Same for your sister and her family. What you told me about Naples. It's no human's fault they are at risk. Not ultimately. Same for any of the other consequences. The geology, the quakes, the mixed-up weather. It's not even the volcano's fault. Because it wouldn't have been destabilised in the first place. Again, it's Galaxius." Grace said, "There are some who say Galaxius has big, noble goals. Keeping the peace in the galaxy over billions of years. You told me about Ella and Billy. Would you take a billion years if your niece's life was the price?" "Of course not. So what are you saying?" Tash, ashamed for eavesdropping, but feeling this was somehow important, pushed a little closer. Strained to hear as Regent spoke more softly, under the wider hubbub. "There are some of us, mostly military or ex, like you and me, who don't approve of the way the governments have responded to all this. Not about managing the emergencies. I mean the response to Galaxius. So they have Serena Jones firing off toy rocket ships out to where the sun went. The Chinese are fooling around on Mercury. So what? What good does that do? Galaxius isn't on Mercury. Galaxius is out there somewhere." Grace pressed again. "What are you saying?" He looked at her. "Would you take the call?" "What call?" "Well, I don't know. None of us does. But something might come up. Would you take the call?" If Grace answered, Tash didn't hear. Because now she had reached Fred Bowles. And within 30 seconds, she'd received orders to draft a position paper for Fred to brief Prime Minister Kane on the latest developments. And was running back out of the chaotic room, dragging her phone out of her pocket. Hoping Mel didn't commit any more indiscretions. Hoping that Jane could be protected. Wondering if she should say something to Grace. Or about her, to security. She recoiled from the thought. Confused, conflicted, she pushed through the crowd,